being in great shape is hard. Being overweight is hard. Being an entrepreneur is hard. Working a 9-to-5 is hard. Being poor is hard. Being rich is hard. Having no friends is hard. Sometimes having a lot of friends is hard. Having a great marriage is hard. Divorce is also hard. Literally everything in life is hard. This sounds super like pessimistic. Doesn't make for great motivational speaking. But everything in life is going to cost something. Is going to be painful. The question is, what cost are you willing to pay? And you pay that willingly and happily because you value it.
After that clip, you know the rest is going to be good. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you're here. Today's conversation is with Mitchell Osman. Mitchell is the founder of Dad Nation Co., and a man who knows the power of asking the right questions at the right time. Mitchell's story reads like a masterclass in transformation. Nearly divorced, 60 pounds overweight, and drowning in debt, he faced the questions most men avoid. Within 18 months, he rebuilt everything: his marriage, his health, his finances, and his sense of purpose. That journey from rock bottom to renewal didn't just change his life, it became his life's work. Today, Mitchell reaches over 22,000 ambitious men monthly, hosts a top-rated podcast with 33,000 listeners, and runs a thriving executive coaching practice. His mission? To help high performers find strength, not just in boardrooms, but in living rooms, challenging what true success looks like for modern men. Mitchell, welcome to Curated Questions.
Thank you for having me today, brother. Looking forward to having this conversation with you, man.
Sweet. Indeed. I always like to start at the same spot, and that is to find out a little bit of a backstory. And when did you first understand the power of questions?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that the first time a question really changed my life and I realized that, and that's how I realized the power of it, which I'm happy to jump into my transformation story or my origin story. But I was at a funeral and I was asked to sing at this funeral of this wealthy man who's a philanthropist. There's a couple thousand people in the room. And as the minister finished talking about all that he had done and the life that he had lived, he asked the congregation there at the church a question that I heard, and I don't even know how I heard it because I had my headphones in getting ready to sing, that it changed my life. And there's a lot of reasons why, but he simply asked the room, "Are you living a life worthy of imitation? If you were to die today, would you be proud of the legacy that you left?" And for me, Ken, like I was in a situation like you alluded to in my intro. I was 100 grand in debt, 60 pounds overweight, medicating daily with drugs and alcohol, on the verge of divorce, like legit. My wife said 7 days before that, "This is over."
Wow.
And I had no idea what to do. And all I could think as I was trying to choke out the lyrics to that last song was, if this was my funeral, no one would be saying, "Man, I want to model the marriage he had. I want to model his value of health and fitness. I want to model his finances, how he provided for his family." At that point in my life, they would have said, yeah, he struggled. He had a tough life, and then it was over. And so for me, I basically left that church determined to change my story, to rewrite my future, because I came from a dysfunctional upbringing. Right? My father was an alcoholic, drug user, crime, sexual abuse, you name it. It was all in my home growing up. I was littered with that dysfunction. And there was this generational cycle, this generational curse, if you will, where man after man after man struggled with the same things. I left that church that day with this statement in my head. I know that every family has a curse breaker, and I am determined to be the curse breaker for my family. And so I went on a journey, a transformation journey, and like you said, over 18 months. But the question that changed everything for me was that question: are you living a life worthy of imitation? If you were to die today, would you be proud of the legacy that you left? Those are two questions, but they were the ones that sunk deep into my heart and started that change, you know, that thirst, that hunger for something different, for me to break that cycle for me and those I love. So that was when I realized the power of questions. Yeah.
Why do you think that you were so ready to actually really wrestle with that question? I'm assuming out of the 2,000 people that were in attendance, that there were others that heard the question and it bounced right off, right? And some people may have had a conversation as they went home with others in the car. But clearly, you were soil ready for that seed. Mm-hmm. So why do you think that that was the case?
Desperation. Probably. I mean, I always say trauma leads to transformation. And that was a traumatic moment for me. I had a flash forward in that moment of what my life was going to become. Alone, overweight, depressed, more alcohol, more drugs. Just like my father and his father and his father. I realized that what I was doing was not working. And I came to grips with the fact that the decisions that I made got me to where I was in my life. And I had to take ownership of that. And so for me, there was this raw moment of true honesty with myself that I think very few people get to. And I would love to say that I got there before it got too late, you know, or I had the wisdom to change and course correct, but I didn't, you know, as so many people.
Welcome to the human condition.
Exactly. Yeah. I got to the point where my wife literally said, I'm done, you know, and I was in such a difficult position that there was no other avenue. And so for me, I think it was a combination of just the sobering weight of the funeral, the significance of that moment, the clarity that I got from the vision of the future of my life, and the honesty that I was facing for the first time. And I'm weirdly obsessed with death, like more, it's kind of morbid, but I truly believe the more you are aware of your mortality, the more profound of a life you will live. Stephen Covey said this in chapter 2 in his book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, is begin with the end in mind, right? Napoleon Hill said, begin with the end in mind. Have you ever heard the story of Alfred Nobel and his turning point?
It's flickering as far as with dynamite and that kind of thing, right?
Real quick, Cole's notes.
Yeah, please.
So Alfred Nobel, we all know him as to be the guy who invented the Nobel Peace Prize and the foundation and all that stuff. He was one of the people, one of the very few people on earth that had got an opportunity to see the legacy that he was going to leave. So what happened was Albert's brother died, okay? And Alfred at this point was famous for creating nitroglycerin, which if you know what nitroglycerin is, TNT, it's dynamite, right? Yeah. And at this point, this was one of the most purchased weapons for killing. I think at that point, the weapon that was responsible for the most deaths in the world. And so essentially, I mean, that's how he made his fortune. But what happened was the local newspaper got the names wrong and they thought that Alfred had died. And so they printed Alfred Nobel's name in the obituary, And so it was on the front page. And so he wakes up and he reads the first page of the newspaper and it says, Dr. Death dies. Now Alfred sees this and his name is on it, right?
Yeah.
And he's faced with a legacy that he left instantly right in front of his face. He was so shaken by this legacy that he sold everything and he determined to dedicate his life to not death and destruction and dynamite, but to peace. And he started the Nobel Peace Foundation and created the Nobel Peace Prize. And so much so that when he died, when he actually died, he left the vast majority of his fortune to the organization. And his family even disputed it in court to try and get some of his wealth. He was so focused because he was faced with his mortality. And for me, to come full circle, for me, that was similar to my moment of like in a funeral, right? I was surrounded by this idea of death. I realized that there will be a day when I draw my last breath and what am I going to have to show for it? You know, and so for me, that all that was so profound, I think, and helped shift that for me.
So the connection to death, had that always been the case, or was that prior to that? And I want to understand the connection. Because once again, it's still this insight that you had, and we'll talk a little bit about, I want to dig into a little bit of your process there in those moments, but that, for lack of a better term, maybe your term, fascination with death or that connection with death, is that something that you had been really aware of prior to that period in your life?
Never. Never. Okay. No one that I really loved or cared about had died. Death was not a part of my life. I never thought about it ever until that moment. And that's when everything shifted. Now, so much so that, for example, I'm a coach. All my clients, I work with men exclusively. That's why I'm saying men. But all of my clients do a eulogy writing exercise. Right? One of the first things we do is I get my clients to write their own eulogy from the perspective of their wives, from the perspective of their partners. What would they say about you and the life that you lived, the father you were, the husband you were, as they stood over your casket, which is wild, right? It's visceral.
Yeah.
It's sobering, but it's so common. Men are broken. They're in tears because they're met with that. And then we get to write a 2.0 version. If you were 100% the man that you knew you could be, the father, the husband, the leader, the entrepreneur, whatever, what would he say then in that eulogy? And then we draw the tension between those two, because the tension between who you are today and who you know you could be, that's where our frustration, our anxiety lies, because we go to bed at night, and especially for men, because we're so ambitious in the sense of like goal-oriented and driven by my career and all those different things. A lot of guys go to bed thinking, I could have done more. I could have been more present with my kids today.
Yeah,
I could have loved my wife better. And so it's so powerful. And so that's why that eulogy writing exercise is so visceral for guys. And it becomes a bit of that cornerstone for change, right?
A previous guest had mentioned that exercise as well, and just talking about how impactful it had been for them to just come face to face with that reality. And so, yeah, powerful.
Well, it's uncomfortable, right? Nobody likes to be uncomfortable today. That's the reason why we're where we are. And also, you don't want to be uncomfortable, but don't dare make anyone else feel uncomfortable,
right?
Or you're going to get canceled. And so it's like this, oh my goodness, I feel like a broken record, because I'm like, our relationship with discomfort is broken, right? And there is a direct relationship, there is direct correlation between our development and our growth and our relationship with discomfort. Right? I know a guy who loves question and is as introspective as you can probably see that as well, right?
I've been thinking about this, reflecting back on this here recently, that I'm like, if I was to have kids again, so mine are grown and out of the house and such, but if I was to start over, I'm like, I think that I would set the expectation of life is hard. things are hard because as I think about my life and my expectations right now, so midlife, right? 55. I'm like, my expectation is life should be easy. Mm-hmm. I should be able to achieve everything that I want in a relatively short amount of time, or right? I have all of these expectations. And I'm like, where do those come from? And it may have been from advertising on TV or something like that. But a lot of it, I think, just comes from this idea that I wasn't necessarily told, or just the influences in my life were not saying, like, life is hard. It can be easier, right? But life is hard. So expect it to be difficult. Those times that you go into the gym, expect it to be difficult because life is hard. This is all part of it. And that is okay. Mm-hmm. You're not failing because life is hard. You're not failing if you're pushing hard and trying to do it. I'm trying to reprogram myself now to just be comfortable with that uncomfortableness, to say, yeah, if I'm trying to change the world, it's probably going to be more difficult, because otherwise it would have been done by everybody else. That resonates deeply with me right now. And I'm talking about how we expect it to be so easy, that pushing away from discomfort.
Yeah, it's significant. And there's a lot of different variations of this online, but I'll probably butcher it. But this really puts things into perspective. Being in great shape is hard. Being overweight is hard. Being an entrepreneur is hard. Working a 9-to-5 is hard. Being poor is hard. Being rich is hard. Having no friends is hard. Sometimes having a lot of friends is hard. One thing that I say a lot is having a great marriage is hard. Divorce is also hard. Literally everything in life is hard. You just have to choose. Everything in life, this sounds super like pessimistic, doesn't make for great motivational speaking, but everything in life is going to cost something, is going to be painful. The question is what cost are you willing to pay, right? And and you pay that willingly and happily because you value it. And so there is a giant misconception that, like you said, life should be easy. Well, it never will be easy. And even our greatest victories are going to be hard, and our greatest failures are going to be hard. And so I say this all the time. If you want peace, if you want contentment, then embrace that. Embrace the fact that nothing is easy and nothing will be given to you. Because as long as you're looking for easy around every corner, as long as you're looking for peace around every corner, you're never going to be happy because it's not there, right? And that's the whole point, because we've been designed for adversity. We've been built to overcome. And that's where the true strength comes from. Well, you talked about working out. How do muscles grow? You grow your muscles by tearing the muscle fibers. I'm a fitness trainer as well. That's actually how it happens. The growth happens in repair while you sleep. You don't get big muscles by just pushing weight around. You actually tear your body. You don't get a great marriage by never fighting. You get it by the struggle, by the wrestling, by the conflict, right? So that concept, and I parked here for a little bit, that concept is so significant. And I think so much of my generation, the millennials and the Gen Zs, really wrestle with that. You know, and sometimes I get on shows and I say it and it's not popular and they don't like that I said it. But that's the reality of where we're at. Right?
I want to live in a world of truth. Mm-hmm. And so let's just camp out in truth, because it seems to be kind of rare. Yes, let's acknowledge it, because then now I understand the rest of my world, because I recognize that it is going to be hard. Mm-hmm. And so now I don't have to try to blame it on me or blame it on somebody else because it's hard. We can just acknowledge that, oh, no, it's difficult, and this is how it is. Okay, great. Now let's move forward in light of that. And as you say, it's embracing that is truth, that is reality. So now what do we do with that? How do we move forward in light of that? And just know that we'll always have that gravity pressure on us, pulling on us that says, yeah, it's going to be hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I say to my son now. I'm like, we do hard things. As a family, we do hard things. And we don't run away from it. We actually pride ourselves in that. We see something difficult, we dig in. Because that's how you make change. That's how you feel good at the end of the day. Who has ever went to sleep, put their hand on the pillow at night when they wasted 8 hours at the company they were working for? They scrolled or whatever the whole time and like they weren't productive. Anybody go to sleep just feeling like 10 out of 10, like they were $1 million? No, you feel lazy, you feel apathetic. You feel like, I feel like I cheated someone or something. But if you put in a good, honest day's work and you work your butt off, man, you sleep better at night because we're designed for it, right? And so it's this idea of adversity and work. And it's like, and that's why for me and my wife, it's like we are setting that culture in our family. And as we have more kids and as we grow, this is going to be a bit of a mantra for us. It's like we do hard things and they're not, the hard things don't mean they're bad. Hard things don't mean we're failing. In fact, hard things mean we're probably doing something right. Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. So I want to understand how you, for lack of a better term, celebrate or acknowledge that you did hard things. Because where I'm going with this is that when I was raising the kids, there's a book that came out talking about do hard things. We read the book, but I don't have any particular memory about really driving that home and saying, okay, son, you did this today or at the end of the day, right? I noticed that you did this hard thing, and acknowledging that that is the hard thing, right? We talked about it in the abstract, even maybe going through the examples in the book, but then that connection point to this is what it actually looked like on a daily or weekly basis and how you're pushing through or at least fighting the fight,
mm-hmm.
rather, even if you fail. So what is that looking like for you with your family in acknowledging the presence and the persistence in the hard things?
That's such a great question. Thank you for asking it. I'll answer it in a couple different ways. For me personally, I journal every night and I write down three things. Number one, the three wins from the day. Then I write three wins that I'm looking for tomorrow. And then I basically take just some time to be grateful for the difficulty, for the easy, for it all. But what happens then is when I go to sleep, I've already listed the three things, the three goals, the three adversities, the three challenges I'm going to face the next day, the three areas I'm looking for wins in. So I'm priming my subconscious mind to go to work, to think about solutions, to get to solve those problems. But also before I go to bed, I'm reflecting on the three things, the three challenging parts that I had breakthrough in, or the three things that I move forward. And so I'm in a sense celebrating the breakthrough. I'm celebrating the wins from the day. So yeah. I'm associating those challenges with a positive payoff, right? Three wins, huge. And I'm priming my mind for tomorrow. You will face adversity. There will be three things that you're going to try and push forward, three wins you're looking for, whatever that is. And so you're priming yourself to start to get up with a clear vision to be motivated to face it all that next day, right? So that's one practical journaling thing I do. But with my son, it's a question of like, and I asked this to my wife as well, because we're really intentional about creating, identifying pockets of joy in our day and challenges, mm-hmm. because joy is not natural. We don't just naturally joyful. We have to look for it, gratitude, yeah. all those things, you know that. But I asked my son, what was hard about today, right? What was hard about today? What was something you faced and how'd you get through it? And then alternatively, what was great about today? And then how can I support you in the hard thing? How can I help you in the hard thing, right? So what's happening and what's interesting is usually when I say the hard thing, I ask him what the hard thing was and then what the great thing was, they're usually connected. The hard thing was, well, I had this hard conversation with my best friend, or this test was really hard. Well, what was the great thing? Well, we made up and we're buds again, or I got an A plus on that test. So it's interesting that they're usually connected, you know, which is brilliant, because that's what you want to do. You want to create a positive relationship with difficulty. And I'll ask my wife the same thing. It's like, what was hard about today? What was great about today? And how can I support you in the hard thing? What can I do to serve you? What can I do to help you? And specifically before we go to bed, because we want the last things that we're speaking out loud, the last things we're thinking about, to be seeds planted in our subconscious mind while we go to sleep. And so filling that, those last few moments with gratitude, with, you know, celebrating overcoming adversity and preparing ourselves for the adversity to come the next day, is a great way, I think, to prime your mind for that. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Not so much that it's a difficult thing, but I remember another story of Josh Waitzkin when he was on the Tim Ferriss podcast, and he was talking about how every time it rained, he would take his son out, who was like 3 or 4, so very young. He would take him out and they go outside and they would play in the rain. Hmm. It was intentionally, because we so often say, oh, it's raining outside, so it's a bad day. And that was intentional to say, no, we're disconnecting a bad day from a rainy day. Mm. And we're saying that there can be joy in the rain.
Mm-hmm.
And just that mind shift, right? Or that kind of training. So I love in your example there how you're inspiring the leaning into the discomfort or the hard parts of the day, because you're, what's also naturally happening is it's getting tied back to some of the best things that are happening in the day.
Exactly.
I'm excited for your kids' future, right? And just having this mindset moving through the world, it's just going to be healthier folks, understanding that life is hard, but they'll also be able to look back at this massive track record of doing hard things, pushing through, and then succeeding in whatever capacity they do. Good on you, you and your wife, and doing that and being intentional about that. So, like Sam, excited for the opportunity that your kids will have to have you as parents.
Thank you, man.
Encountering that growth experience. Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, it's funny because even like I get looks from parents all the time. When my son was learning how to walk, he'd fall down and I'd be like, all right, let's get up. How are you going to get up? Brush it off. I'm not going to pick you up, because I'm not going to be here to pick you up when you're 30 years old. I'm not raising kids. I'm raising adults.
Yes. Amen.
Right. And so I'm not raising this kid to think he's going to be picked up every time he falls down. And so parents at the playground are like, well, looking at me like, what kind of dad doesn't pick up his son? Like, he's got to learn. You know what I mean? And it's just even some simple things like that, right? I'm always thinking about that. How can I set him up for success? And usually it's not the thing that feels intuitive, because the thing that feels intuitive is to make it easy for him, to give him everything he didn't have, but to hand him everything on a silver platter or a silver spoon.
Yeah.
That's going to set him up for failure, right? Anyways.
Yeah. Good stuff, man. Good stuff. So if we can go back a little bit to that low point for you, I want to ask you about those days or that pause that happened after you had that insight. Because what I'm assuming is that you didn't go from the church and the funeral directly to the gym and call a nutritionist and set a date night for your wife to talk through all the hard stuff within 30 minutes of leaving the church. I'm assuming that that's the case. You can tell me if I'm wrong, right? But so what did that short time period look like for you after you had the insight and as you were preparing to do the follow-on changes? And I want to get to those because I want to talk about the questions and how that informed. What did it look like in that time frame right after you had that insight?
Yeah. For me, there's a lot of motivation in the beginning, which was great. That went away pretty quickly. But there was that of like, okay, I'm going to change. I got to do this. And I talk a lot about the self-sabotager and the imposter syndrome and all those different things, because that'll come up too. Once you're on this high, when you get this revelation, but then that goes away pretty quickly. But for me, a question that really stuck into my head, and I still ask all my clients this, and I ask this on the podcast, how's that working for you? That thing, that way you've been living, those decisions you've been making, that marriage you have, your bank account, the way you're managing your finances, the way you're taking care of your physical health, how's that working for you? And it's a pushback, you know. And then when I ask people that, their guard comes up, right? It's like, well, what do you mean? And that was for me. Like, I had to be faced with that reality of, it's not. How I was living is not working for me, was not working for me. How the decisions I was making got me exactly to where I was, right? Yeah. I mean, I say this all the time, and you've probably heard this. Your life is a direct result of the decisions you've made over the last 3 to 5 years. When I think about the decisions I was making from 2020, you know, 2022, 2023, to where I am now, it makes total sense as to why I'm exactly where I am. Now, if I want my life to be different in 3 to 5 years from now, I need to be making decisions today that are going to get me to that future that I desire. Otherwise, if we don't make different decisions, then we're just going to get more of the same. We know that 95% of the decisions we make today are the exact same as the decisions we made yesterday. It's true, right? And we live the vast majority of our lives on autopilot. And that's the problem. We never ask sobering questions. We never challenge our beliefs. We never challenge our decisions. And so that's why we wake up 5 years later and we're like, what happened to the last 5 years? Or wait a minute, my life looks exactly like it did 5 years ago. Well, of course, because 95% of your decisions are always the same way. And so for me, that was a question that I was asking. That was a reality that I was faced with. Was like, how is what I'm doing working for me? And the moments between there and when I got some mentors into my life and when I got the gym membership and I hired a counselor and all those different things, there were moments of desperation. There was a moment of pleading with my wife, give me 6 months. And I know it's a boy cried wolf. I know I've said I'd turn it around, but could you give me 6 months? In those moments, there was a bit of a plea, I think, of desperation for sure. But this clarity of like, if I don't change, I can't expect anything different. That's Einstein's definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing, but expecting different results. And so that's why we talk so much about how we're wired, because I was a product of my parents, my upbringing. Yeah. I was making the same decisions my dad did, and his dad did, and his dad did, right? And it wasn't working for me. And my dad might have thought it worked for him, and his dad might have thought it worked for him. It doesn't work for me. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. Now, with your wife, why do you think she said yes again? What was different about it this time that, although she had, you know, the boy that cried wolf type of scenario, she had said yes before. Was there something different about this time, or you think she was just holding out hope once again?
Yeah, I said, if I don't turn it around in 6 months, you can leave. I give you permission to walk away. If I break another promise, I'll happily sign the papers, because you've given me chance after chance. But at that point, I had always said, no, we can work it out. No, we can, you know. But at that point, I was like, I'm so serious about this. I'm so determined that if after 6 months you're not happy with this, it's kind of like a money back guarantee. Get your money back, right? If you're not happy, okay, I get it, right? I'll let it go. I'll let you go, because you don't deserve to be in this relationship anyways. And when I had the boldness, the audacity to say that, because I'm a traditional person, I'm a person of faith. I come from a Christian background and like my own faith. And she knew that staying together was a big value of mine, right? That divorce was never something I would ever consider. And so for me to have the audacity to say that and to willingly let her go, she was like, oh, this guy means business. And I think that's why she said it. That's why she gave me the chance.
Wow. Other than how has that worked out for you now, what were some of the other questions that you used in your journey that may have been companions for it with you?
Mm-hmm. I'll think back to a couple, because that time was so messy and so blurry, and there was a lot that was going on. But some of the there's a couple questions that were going on in my head. One was, do you want to be alone for Christmas this year?
Hmm.
And I came to that point where I was in positions of leadership. I was living a double life, man. I had the career, I had the titles, I had the accolades, but at home, like I said, divorce, the, you know, marriage was on the verge of divorce. I was unhealthy. I was broke. And I had this moment of realizing, what's the point in the titles, the career, all those different things, if I'm going to be sitting around the Christmas tree alone this year while my wife and kids celebrate in the home that we built together, right? And I'm renting some cold apartment, sitting around a little Christmas tree by myself.
Charlie Brown Christmas
exactly.
tree, right?
And none of that matters.
Yeah.
None of that matters if I'm alone. And so for me, that was a moment of like, do I want to be alone this Christmas or not? And that question was visceral enough to keep me going for the next 5 months leading up to Christmas, right? Hmm. That kept me motivated. Because I'm like, if we can stay together, we can have Christmas as a family, right? And so it was these glimpses of short-term wins 6 months from now. That was super helpful for me. Another question that was a spinoff from, are you living a life worthy of imitation? Because I was thinking about my legacy. And this is a question I ask every single one of my clients is, what do you want to be known for? If there were people at a bar having a pint and they were talking about Mitch, what would they be saying? If your wife was standing over your coffin, what would she be saying? What do you want to be known for? Do you want to be known for a man who built a lot of great businesses but lost your entire family? Do you want to be known, or do you want to be known as a man who loved his family, who gave to his community, who was fully present, who made people feel loved, appreciated, you know? Because whether you like it or not, you're leaving something, right?
Yeah.
So what do you want to leave? We all think about it. It's like, you live in autopilot. There are people who think something about you. And I don't care who you are. If you're alive on this earth, you're leaving something when you die. You're leaving thoughts, memories, opinions, legacies, right? What is it? We talk about your personal brand in my space where I'm building online business and stuff like that. It's like, well, what's your brand? Your brand today is like your legacy, right? You don't have to have some big company to have a personal brand, really. I mean, it's those who are closest to you. What would they say about you? What do you want to be known for? And for me at that point, I was known to be a workaholic. I cared about my career. I drank too much, right? I had a temper. I was known to have a wife that wasn't happy. I was known to be a little overweight. I was known to be very, I was not consistent. I was an extremist. So those were some of the things that I was known for. And when I asked myself that question, Mitchell, what do you want to be known for? When I honestly, talk about honesty, right? When I honestly answered that question and I started writing down the things, I was not happy with the list that I made. So then I made a list of the things that I did want to be known for. And then I quickly realized what I said I wanted and the actions that I were taking were very different.
Gotcha. Yeah.
For example, when I play this out with clients, it's like, what do you want to be known for? I want to be known to be a loving father, to be a great husband, to give to my community. So then we walk through their calendar, the commitments, and I say, well, you say you want to be a loving, you want your kids to know you love them and your wife to know you love them, but you haven't been home for dinner in the last 3 months. Your actions don't align. Your insides are not matching your outsides. So what does it look like to have our words actually match our intentions? And when we get clarity and honesty, like almost 100% of the time, that's what we're doing, right? We say we want these things, but we're not living in integrity with that.
Yeah.
And what we feel emotionally, that dissonance, that disconnection is a byproduct of us saying we want one thing, but living another. We want to be in shape, but we keep hitting McDonald's drive-thru on the way home, right? We want to have a great marriage, but every time our wife talks, we're scrolling on Instagram. We're not paying attention. You understand what I mean?
Tracking. And I would love to be able to say that It's because I've only seen it on YouTube and I haven't lived it, but no, I've lived it. I love the beautiful thing about questions and truth, because it just brings that clarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, none of us are going to be perfect. Got that. But let's be honest enough to identify and say, yep, I know that I'm falling short here. I'm doing well in these areas, but there's some gaps here. There's always going to be gaps at some level, because you're not going to, won't be hitting it all perfect, but at least have the integrity to say, this is where I'm at, and to work with those questions and dive in,
mm-hmm.
To acknowledge that and then take action if you're going to actually live in the full integrity of what you say you want to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's such a key point, man, because you know, if you're listening to the show today, I don't know when you're listening or where you are or what you're doing as you're listening to this episode, but hear me say this, I'm not perfect. And the guy who's running this podcast, he's not perfect. Right?
No. Nope.
And we can make the mistake of listening to these people, these influential people, whatever, and say, oh, well, they got it all figured out. No, we don't. I had a conversation two nights ago, if I'm being honest and being really real here. She was like, you literally tell people how to have a great marriage. And like, you, this is what you do all day, but yet you haven't spent any time with me in the last, you know, 5 days. Right? That was real. I was like,
yeah.
I got so focused on events I was launching and courses I was launching. I got so wrapped up in work because I'm driven and I'm motivated that I forgot the very thing that I'm preaching about all day is loving my wife and being there for my kids. You know, so like, I get it wrong too, right? You get it wrong too. And so that's a part of the journey. So just because you're going to start asking yourself questions, you're going to have breakthroughs. But like you said, no one is perfect and we're all going to make mistakes. But the key is, can you get back on the track? Do you have the determination? Do you have the grit to keep asking yourself those questions, to stay honest with yourself? Because what happens with most people is they'll hear an episode like this, it'll juice them up. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to ask myself a question every day or whatever. And they'll do it for a couple of days, like, I don't like how this feels. And then they stop, right?
Yeah.
And because again, the relationship with discomfort, I don't want to feel uncomfortable. This is stretching. Let's not do it. Right. So I hear me say, I don't have this all figured out. I still get it wrong. But the difference is I'm committed beyond anything else to live a life where I'm honest with myself. And I will always force myself to do the hard thing because that's usually the best thing.
Amen to that. Mm. Yeah. You mentioned that you work strictly with men. What questions do you think men are not spending enough time with or not asking themselves or even each other in friendships in today's world?
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite questions in the world. Well, there's two questions. One, I'm 90% sure you will have heard it before. Seth Godin asks it all the time. I think he was the first person I heard ask it, is what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail?
Hmm.
What would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? Now, the reason why that is so important is because we make decisions based off of fear. We live our lives filtered by fear. Yeah. We don't do things because we'll look silly or we'll have egg on our face, or when in reality, it might be the best decision, but the fear of the unknown holds us back. I think it's Virginia Satir, one of my favorite quotes ever. She says, people would prefer the certainty of misery over the misery of uncertainty. People would prefer the certainty of misery over the misery of uncertainty. What that means is, or another way of saying it is more common phrase, is people would prefer a familiar hell over an unfamiliar heaven. Right? So we're just so scared of the unknown. We're afraid of what we don't know that we keep ourselves stuck in the familiar, even if the familiar is bad, even if the familiar is a terrible marriage or being overweight or being stressed or being anxious or caring, you fill in the blank with your thing.
Yeah.
Because that's the devil we know. Well, what if we had a conversation? What if we asked ourselves, well, what if I did this thing, I took this chance, and what if I knew I couldn't fail? I knew that no matter what, I'd be a success. What would you do then? Well, you do a lot of things differently, right? What if I went on this fitness journey and I knew that I would be successful, and then within 6 months, I would drop 60 pounds? What if I knew that if I took this chance to pursue my passion project, that I'd be a successful entrepreneur in a year? Would I do it? What if I knew that if I faced these difficult conversations and I buckled down and I really dug into my marriage, that in a year from now, we would be thriving versus barely surviving? If you knew you would be successful, would you do it? Yeah, 100% of the time, right? That question is so, when we get real and we answer it, all of a sudden we start realizing the decisions that we should be making. This decision was what held me back for 3 years from launching the podcast and my coaching practice, because I thought, so let's go back to my childhood for a second. I was told as a kid, there were three of us siblings, and my oldest sister, I was the baby boy. My oldest sister was always had straight A's, always really smart. So I was always told, you're not the smart one. She's the smart one, right? You're a hard worker. You know, you work with your hands, blah, blah, blah. And so I grew up with this narrative that I wasn't intelligent, that I had nothing to share with the world. So even when I transformed my life, even when, you know, before I did all this, I started helping friends of mine, building out budgets to help them get out of debt, giving them tools to get closer to their wives. I'd go to the gym with friends and help train them. And I was doing it for free because I was passionate about it. Even then, after helping so many of the friends in my social circle, I was still convinced that I had nothing to offer anyone because I was believing that narrative that you're not the smart one. I wrote content for 3 years. I have a Google Doc with over 600 pages of frameworks and strategies and concepts that I was writing because I had to have this output, but I didn't have the courage to take the step because that question, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? If I would have actually answered that, the question would have been, I would have launched a podcast. I would have launched my coaching practice. But I was afraid I was going to fail. I was afraid that nobody would listen to what I had to say. I was afraid that I'd do this thing and people were like, he's not the smart one. I'm not going to listen to him. So that question, not answering that question, held me back for 3 years. Now, when I launched it, I got content for years, you know, but it was like, man, I let fear hold me back for so long.
Wow.
Right? And then within 6 months, the podcast became globally rated top 5% show in the world. So that like that immediately eradicated that negative belief, right? And then 6 months later, I launched a coaching practice that became a six-figure coaching practice within 6 months. And so it's like that, all those things, I mean, I wish I didn't have to learn these lessons such a hard way, but now I can look back and say, I think I do have something to offer the world. I think I do have intelligence. And so that was a powerful question. What would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? The second question, and this is probably my favorite, is what are you tolerating? What are you tolerating in your life? We do this all the time. We tolerate things that we shouldn't necessarily tolerate. We have a problem with boundaries. We tolerate an invasive family member that causes stress and tension to our family. We tolerate our own selves in not following through with our promises and not exercising or not taking care of our health. We tolerate conflict in our marriage and we just let it slide and we start shutting down or we stonewall and we let our marriages erode to the point where we're just roommates sharing rings or we're roommates sharing a mortgage because we're tolerating a lack of connection. We're tolerating broken relationships with our children. I could go on and on. We're tolerating this limiting self-belief that you just let live rent-free in your head and stops you from launching your passion project for 3 years.
Yeah.
What are you tolerating? And then you just write out a list. And usually the things that are most stressful and frustrating in your life are the things that you're tolerating that you shouldn't necessarily be. Now, some things you do have to tolerate, right? Obviously, you're not going to be like, I'm going to get rid of every difficult thing, because that literally contradicts what we were just talking about. But there are things that you're tolerating in your life that you shouldn't be, that if you set healthy boundaries or set the standard higher for yourself and for others, then that goes from a life-draining thing to a life-giving thing. And then all of a sudden, you have more energy, more vitality. You're more pleasant because you're addressing these things. So we make lists, right? Does that make sense? That's a big question.
It does, and I appreciate it. And what comes to mind is, I forget who it was writing-wise. May have been like Hemingway or one of the big names, but the encouragement was write one true thing a day. Mm. That came to mind when you were talking about this list of what am I tolerating. I would suspect that if you sat down to write out that list, what am I tolerating? And if you said, this is the one true thing that I'm going to write today, it comes back to your other question of, what could I do if I knew I wasn't going to fail it? Just write out that list and write it completely, truthfully, and honestly. That list could be transforming. Mm-hmm. I just, because you got to be honest with yourself.
Totally.
If you're writing that out, then you see it clearly.
That's the thing. So many people don't even get to the point where they write out the question. Because even thinking right. about asking yourself that question is like, well, if I ask the question, then I gotta answer it. Right.
Right. Yeah. It now becomes a living thing in the world mm-hmm. because now it exists outside of our head and it's on paper. So that's real. It's not just these voices in my head.
Ah. Well, because now you got to do something about it because you physically wrote that with your hands. And now once you do, that's going to cause even more internal dissonance or tension. Because now you've been honest with yourself. And now you're actually going to look at the honest truth right in front of you that you just wrote with your hand and ignore it. Right? And then you do. And then you're like, you break another promise to yourself. And that's another point. I'll throw in another question. Where are the most broken promises in your life? Mm. I work with a lot of men who have built successful businesses or entrepreneurs or in positions of leadership and are powerful at work, but they feel powerless at home. They've seen professional success, but their personal life is a bit of a mess. Like they're disconnected. And so they're super confident at work, but they feel insecure at home. They don't really know. They're maybe insecure in their fitness, their body. Maybe they're heavier than they want to be. They're not connected with their wife. And so the issue of confidence comes up a lot. The most simple definition of confidence, this simple way to explain it, is the more promises you break, the less confident you will be. If you want to gain self-confidence, make promises and keep them, right? So here's what happens. Okay, so say, for example, I told you that we were going to grab a coffee every Saturday at 10 a.m. at the local Starbucks. And the first Saturday I was there at 10. The next Saturday I showed up at 10:30. The next Saturday I didn't show up at all. And then I just kind of stopped showing up. It wouldn't take very long before you were like, I don't know that I have confidence in Mitchell anymore. Because he made a promise he didn't keep, right? He said he'd show up and he didn't. Now, let's do some internal work for a second. So if I make a promise to myself that I'm going to be present and listen to my wife, put my phone down, or that I'm going to get up at 6 a.m. and I'm going to go to the gym, or I'm going to be fully present with my kids, or fill in the blank with whatever your struggle is. If you make a promise and then you break it, even if you don't tell anyone else that you made the promise or that you broke it, what happens in your subconscious mind is it starts saying things like, well, why should anyone else trust you if you can't trust yourself, right? So the alarm clock analogy is a great one, because once you say, I'm going to get up at 6 a.m. to do whatever, maybe it's to get up and read or to get up and have some quiet time or work out or have some quiet time with your wife or whatever that looks like. When you say no and you turn off the alarm and you go back to sleep, your mind says, well, you're not keeping your promises to yourself. So why should anyone else trust you? Number one. So your confidence begins to erode in yourself because you can't follow through, right? And so, but then on the flip side too, just on that note, when you say no to a promise you made the first thing in the morning, you're psychologically setting yourself up to say no to yourself for the rest of the day. That's why that first test is so important. Because when you say yes, you're priming yourself to continue saying yes. No, I got up at 5:30 this morning. I went to the gym and I did squats, the hardest thing I could do all day. I did that first. Well, you better believe I can take this business call. You better believe I can lead this board meeting because I've been saying yes all day. I've been keeping my promises. And so what happens is when you, on the flip side, when you make promises and you keep them, the opposite happens. Your self-confidence grows. You begin to stack wins. You begin to build rapport with yourself. And before you know it, you are self-confident in those areas. So when I ask the question, where in your life have you broken the most promises? That is where you are most insecure. And that is where you need to start making promises and keeping them. So it might even just be like, if it's a fitness thing, I'm not saying make a promise to go to the gym 6 days a week and only eat chicken, broccoli, and rice. That's ridiculous. Make a small promise that you can keep. Maybe just don't drink any pop for the next 7 days.
Yeah.
Maybe just cut out the gravy. Something small, something simple. And then, oh, I kept that promise for 7 days. Oh, okay. Now you stacked a win. You're like, I can do that. What else can I do? You know, okay, well, maybe let's try something else, right? And so on and so forth. And so making small promises and keeping them is the simplest way to regain that self-confidence. Does that make sense?
It does. And I got a Friday group that we get together and the opening question is what went well? And a couple of weeks ago, my answer was that I kept a promise and I met this writing deadline for this long piece that I wrote. And it was a long piece, complicated and the like. And I was like, that is absolutely on my list of what went well this week. And it was specifically because I kept that promise. I didn't let the deadline slip. And I was like, a 4,000 word thought piece or essay, that's a lot of words to put together. It's not something I could just push out in the last hour before it was due. Mm-hmm. But as you were talking through, I was like, yes, that a very tangible example of how I did it right. But that also reveals as well, it's like, then if you're so proud of that, then it means that I've probably broken other promises to myself, right? And I've let other things slide.
Exactly.
Right? And the answer is absolutely. That's why it stood out so much. And so it resonates deeply. I appreciate that example. Where am I breaking those promises? And then tying it back to confidence. And it's kind of a thermometer of where our confidence is at.
Mm. Yeah. And sometimes that's the most powerful question I'll send my clients. Are you keeping your promises? I'll text them halfway through the week. How are your promises going? Are you keeping them? Right? Are you a man of your word? That's it. And they're like, oh. But that's my job, right? To make you uncomfortable, to press in, because that's what we need. Anyway,
right?
I'm going on a rant, but I'm pretty passionate. No, I
don't consider that a rant. I think this is what we're here to do. Yeah. Right? We're here to tease that out and peel back the layers of the onion a little bit. Mm-hmm. So for those folks that are doing well, how do you see them using questions?
Well, number one, keep asking questions because that's what's going to keep you in that great place, mm-hmm. right? Absolutely. But the sneaky thing about success is the next thing that follows success is usually incompetence or apathy or you name it because they just get lazy. It's like, now we're here. Now I got the goal. I made the money. I built the business. Or now my wife's happy. Well, let's pull the gas off, right? That was hard work. Mm-hmm. That was hard work. Well, now I'm here. Whew, I've arrived. And what happens? All these old habits start creeping back in. Your diet starts slipping, whatever. All of a sudden, you start scrolling on your phone instead of connecting with your wife, or you're not paying attention to your kids like you should. You're losing your cool because you're not practicing mindfulness. And so the first encouragement would be to keep asking those questions. All the ones we've been talking about, all of these are powerful. the second question I would encourage them to ask and to make a part of their rhythm is around defining success for yourself. So what does success look like for me? Because the problem with success is we live in a day and age in a world where everyone else is defining success for us. Instagram is defining success. The 23-year-old multimillionaire that made his fortune on YouTube is setting the success that makes me angry when I go to sleep at night because I'm a 39-year-old and I haven't done that yet. That looks like success. My brother-in-law or father-in-law or the neighbor down the street that has the big fancy boat, you know, fill in the blank with whatever you're comparing yourself to is they're writing your success story. The problem with that is this is a moving target. And let's say, for example, you do get the boat. Well, wait a minute. Now he's got a sports car. Well, now I got to get a sports car, right? Or the problem is you go on Instagram and there's another guy who he's a multimillionaire, but this guy's jacked. Well, now I got to get jacked because that's what success looks like, right? And so we live in a world that's constantly writing that story of success. And if we don't know what that looks like for us, if we haven't defined what success looks like, we keep grabbing at everything else and we're never happy. There's a book called The Gap and the Gain by Benjamin Hardy and Dan Sullivan. Phenomenal book. The overview of the book is you can live in the gap or the gain. Now, the gap is when we look forward and we're constantly striving for some unmet expectation or undefined goal. We don't know what it is we're stretching for, but it's something. It's success. Yeah. It's whatever. And we let other people define that. It's a moving target. It's like the horizon. It's kind of like me and you were in the rowboat in the middle of the ocean. And I'm like, man, if we just row fast enough and we get to where the sky meets the sea, then I'll be happy. But the problem is the faster you row to the horizon, the faster it gets away from you, right?
Yeah.
And so we constantly live in this gap mentality. We're trying to stretch to get that thing versus the gain, living in the gain, looking backward and saying, wow, I may not be a YouTube all-star or I may not have a six-pack, but I've lost 40 pounds over the last year. I've built this business over the last year. I went 7 days without snapping at my wife. I was fully present. And so you look at the progress you've made and then let that propel you into the future. But here's the thing. Either way, you're going to get to the future. Surprise. But which version of you do you want to get there? The one who's stretched out and stressed about all the things he hasn't done yet and doesn't really know what he wants? Or the version of you that's constantly celebrating every victory along the way and it has peace and contentment on the way? And how you answer that is by asking yourself that question, what does success look like for me? And so I'll have my clients write out their own personal success statements because that looks different for everybody.
Yeah.
And so if you're a guy who's a busy entrepreneur, for example, and success professionally is great, that's easy, but you have a hard time because you're feeling disconnected in your marriage or you got a problem with losing your cool with your kids because you're impatient. Well, you might say, and then you're going to write out your success statement. I'll know I'm being successful when ... Could be, I plan a date night every 2 weeks with my wife. I'll know I'm being successful when I can go 7 days without snapping at my kids. I'll know I'm being successful when, and then you basically make your own success statements, however many you want, but you get to set the terms. And then every month, pull it up. I don't care if you print it off, tape it on your wall, on your monitor, because then you start living by your measuring stick. And I'll tell you, man, the peace and contentment you have from that, I've seen that list and be like, by my definition, I am successful. And that's all I need, right? Versus constantly stretching to see what everyone else is doing and comparing yourself to everyone else, which, by the way, comparison is the ultimate robber of joy. If you want to have a joyless life, start comparing yourself to everybody else. Start comparing your marriage to everyone else. Start comparing your house to everyone else's. You'll lose your joy pretty quick. So these success statements, so helpful. So that's a huge question. What does success look like for me as a mom, as a wife, as a husband, as a father, as a leader, whatever, right?
Yes. All the opportunities that we have to scroll are certainly driving and pushing us in all these different directions and seeking to define that for us. And appreciate that idea of how do I define success? Me alone. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? And that may change, but at least for today, what does that look like? Right. And then it can always be revisited as we change and grow.
Well, and that's the thing. You revisit that list, whether it's quarterly, biannually, once a year, and then you look at the list. Am I still being successful? Do I have new metrics of success? Because naturally we change and we evolve. And so eventually, because that's the thing. Now, let's go back to the example I used. Your definition of success, the couple I used were personal, not professional, but I can go, I'm going to date my wife every 2 weeks. I'm going to go 7 days without snapping at my kids. Okay, well, if I've done that over the last 6 months, remember, I've been keeping promises to myself. These are promises at the end of the day. Now I'm more confident. And now the bar just got higher, right? And I've been doing that for 6 months. You're going to look at your success statements and say, I could be more successful, right? I might want to say, I'm going to date my wife once a week, or I'm going to truly listen to her. And every time she speaks to me, I'm going to put my phone down, or I'm going to go 2 weeks without losing my cool and my kids, right? Or whatever. Yeah. And so you increase that measuring stick while simultaneously keeping promises, building your self-confidence. And that's why people get to a point where they live such a wild life. And you look at some people and you're like, how are you so disciplined? Well, that is exactly how, right? But you do it on your terms. You define success for yourself, and you constantly ask yourself that as you go, is this still serving me? Great. Do I want to increase the mile marker or the post on this? Great. Let's do it. Or maybe not. Maybe you get to a point where you're like, this is awesome. I'm just going to put this on autopilot for the next 6 months because we're in a really good space right now, you know? But yeah, I hopefully that serves you and your listeners well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super helpful. I like to ask folks to become very present in asking what their right now question is. So this is something that's different than what am I going to have for lunch and if I'm going to get married, but comes to the very much the present time, and look at the questions that you personally are working with right now. What are your right now question or questions?
Yeah. So if I can get personal real quick, I lost my nephew a year and a half ago to a drunk driving accident. And sweet boy, he was only 17 and I loved him dearly. And when I went through that journey of grieving his death, we had the 1 year anniversary and a lot of things were really unearthed and came back up for me. And I was met with this, again, with this sobering thought of, how am I spending my time? There's a quote that I love that says, time is the only currency you spend without knowing the remaining balance. Time is a currency, whether you like it or not. You don't know how much you have left, but we spend it on the silliest things. We give it away frivolously, you know? Yeah. And it's like, man, I don't know if I have 60 minutes or 60 years. I have no clue.
Right.
My nephew, when he was sitting around the fire with his friends, got up from that campfire. He didn't know that he had 15 minutes left to his life. And he got in the truck and started driving. What would he have done? How would he have lived differently if he knew I had 15 minutes left? What would he have said to the people around the fire? If he knew that morning when he woke up that his life would be over tonight, how differently would he speak to his mother? What messages would he send? How present would he be? And so for me, the question I've been asking myself is that, right? How am I spending the time I have? And it has drawn me in to be so present because I'm so work focused and I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I'm so driven. I'm so ambitious to a fault, right? And that what I see in a lot of clients of mine and just in the world in general and again, I'm talking a lot about men because I work with men, but a lot of men will lose the family. The irony is they'll lose the family they were working so hard to provide for because they drown in work. They get so overwhelmed with it. And I am that guy, if I'm honest. Like, if I'm not careful, I can be that guy. And that's the entire reason why I started the podcast, why I started the movement, because the best chance I have at being the best father and husband I can be is to make my life about preaching this and talking about this, because I have these addictive tendencies and I come from trauma. I come from alcoholism. I've had to do so much work to sort of repair all that. But for me, I have to be very, very intentional about my time and how I spend it, because I will give it to work and I'll get tunnel focused and I'll lose track of the family. I'll lose track of time. I could spend time in my office recording a podcast or writing something. I'd be here for like 6, 7, 8 hours. My wife would knock on the door, be like, "You hungry? You want some food? Have you eaten today?" You know, and so how am I spending my time? And am I giving it to the things that matter the most? And often I'm not, right? If I'm honest, I got to be really careful about that. So that's one question I've been asking myself a lot lately.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And sorry about the loss of your nephew. Yeah.
Well, you know what? It's tough for sure. But it certainly has brought an awareness and a closeness to his family that, you know, he left behind, right? Like all of us who have been mourning his death, we've saw more unity and family coming back together because now we're aware of how precious life is, you know? And so to your listeners, I would encourage you with that quote, "Time is the only currency we spend without knowing the remaining balance. Live as though you don't know how much time you have left," right? Like, old age is a gift that is not afforded to everyone. And so that's significant. And that's one question that's been haunting me lately, but in a good way, right?
Yeah. That's beautiful. So on the podcast, can you talk a little bit about what you're accomplishing there? And although anybody can listen to it, but what are you, kind of the target audience and who you're seeking to serve with that podcast?
Yeah, thank you for asking, man. I really appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about it. You know, Ed Milette said this on a podcast a little while ago, and I know he's not the originator of it, but he said, "You are the most qualified to help the person you used to be," right? And that, what, have you heard that before as well?
Actually, I just heard Ed Milette say that like 2 months ago or 6 weeks ago at an event. And that was, I wrote that down in my book and I was like, this resonates with me.
Yes.
This, hearing this was worth the price of the ticket.
Yes.
So keep going. I am with you 100%. Keep going, man.
It's powerful, right? And that's what I've made my life about, is helping the man I used to be. And that's who I created the podcast for. The man who's dominating at work, but disconnected at home. The man who felt like he was doing all the right things, but yet, you know, things are just feeling disconnected. Like like I said earlier, he feels powerful at work, but powerless at home. He wants to have a stronger connection with his kids. He wants to have a stronger marriage, but the puzzle pieces don't quite fit together. And he gets it at work. He gets the business piece. He gets the career piece. That's easy. But he struggles because he doesn't really know where he fits, or feels like he says the wrong things, or maybe he finds himself checking out and things like that. One of my statements is, I help high-performing men reclaim their home, their health, and their happiness. And so at the end of the day, the home piece is key relationships, right? Wife, partner, kids. The health is all about your physical health, nutrition, exercise, all those things. Happiness is really about your mindset and emotions, right? Understanding how to keep your cool, how to regulate your nervous system, but also understanding your wiring and how, you know, where you came from and the way you see the world, and eliminating the self-sabotage and these limiting self-beliefs. Because we know that today, up to 80% of how we see ourselves and the way we see the world was formed before we were 12 years old, which is crazy. That's why we have to look to the past, right? And so the podcast is made for men like that. I teach often frameworks and stuff that I teach my one-to-one clients. I'll do solo episodes, but I also bring in guest experts and professionals in the space, We have coming up, we have John Gray, the guy who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, one of the most popular relationship books ever written in all time. Yeah. I'm going to have him on the show in a few weeks here. So obviously very equipped to talk about how to have a great relationship. And so whether it's relationships, business, fitness, mindset, it's all those things. Anything that would challenge a man, husband, father to, you know, to anything that he might be struggling with is what we talk about. And I also have a bunch of listeners who are women, but they listen because they want to understand the mind of their husband. They want to get through to their husband. And so they listen to understand their husbands better. And so that's what I do. That's the podcast called the Dad Nation Podcast. Like I said earlier, it's a top 5% globally rated podcast. And I have listeners. I was talking to a guy from Korea a couple of days ago over the DMs. And I was like, what? How did you hear about this show in Korea? But yeah, it's just a ton of fun. And the coaching platform is the exact same thing. I do group coaching. I have a program called the High Performance Husband, and where guys just get together and sharpen the edge, and we tackle all this stuff. And then for the right person, I do one-to-one. But yeah, man, that's what I offer.
That's beautiful. And I love how you've been so intentional. If we go back to your challenging that voice that said you don't have something to say. Mm. And what you've built as a result of A, staying true to who you are, but pushing back on that voice. Mm. The whole reason I'm doing what I'm doing is I have a specific story of a guy in a backyard in Southeast DC where in a loving manner, he was like, you think you got something to say, don't you? Shout out to Raymond Coates. And my response was, yes, I'm just not sure what it is. And much of what I'm doing here at the podcast is about that and finding that and pursuing it. And so I appreciate the fact that you have found your voice and not only found it, but refining what your voice is and your message and seeking to serve those that are ready to hear. So
thank you.
It's amazing work that you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate that affirmation, man. I love what you're doing as well. I mean, we obviously have a lot of the same, I think, beliefs, and I'm convinced that questions have changed my entire life. And it wasn't until I asked myself questions and got honest that my life dramatically shifted. Before then, I wasn't questioning anything. I was living in oblivion. I was living in just ignorance, really. And so that's a beautiful thing, is you can't ask questions and then not answer them. I mean, I guess you can, but it's not going to do you any good. But the second you start asking questions is usually the second your life starts to change.
As we head towards wrapping up here, are there any pockets of questions for you that we hadn't touched on?
No, I think we hit a lot.
Okay, cool. Well, where is the best place for folks to catch up, see what you're doing, follow what you're doing, perhaps reach out? What are those touch points for you?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll share that. And I'll share a quick tool too that people can benefit from. So yeah, you can check out the Dad Nation podcast. If you just Google it, my face is plastered all around. You'll see it. But the website is dadnationco.com, and reach out. I check my emails. If you email me, I will respond to you, not an AI bot. And I would love to connect with you for sure. That's real simple. Something I'd love to tell your listeners about is something that I've created called the Spark Starter Kit. Now, what's crazy about this, and let me share a statistic with you. Like I said, a lot of the men that I work with are really wrestling in their marriage sometimes, right? And so in the US today, 70% of divorces are initiated by the women in the relationship, 70%. But if you dig into those statistics, If in the relationships, the wife is a high earner or has a high education, that number actually jumps to 90%, meaning 9 out of every 10 marriages that end in divorce are initiated by the woman. Now, of those divorces, I know it's crazy, right? 80% of the time, the reason cited is because of a lack of emotional connection. It's not fighting about money. It's not abuse. It's not cheating. It's that the wife feels disconnected emotionally from the husband. This is a huge red flashing amber light, okay? Yeah. And so what I've done is created a tool for men to connect with their wives on an emotional level, because every single client I've ever had struggled with this. So inside the Spark Starter Kit is 300, what I say, it's your romance on autopilot for an entire year. It's 365 pre-written text messages that you copy and paste and personalize to send to your wife for every situation, whether you want to repair and reconnect, or you want to turn up the heat, or you just want to appreciate her and, you know, all those different things, encourage her. 365 texts, 52 date night blueprints, that dates that are planned for you. All you have to do is show up and look like a hero. There's 100 spark starter conversations. Remember, I talked about emotional connection. Yeah. These are conversation starters designed to draw her out and connect with her on an emotional level. And the last thing in this kit is a three-part mini course called Romance Reset, which teaches men the step-by-step process to, if they feel like they're stuck in that roommate mode, to reset the romance in the relationship. And I've made it super cheap. It's like, I think $17 right now. It's like cheaper than a bouquet of flowers that, let's be real, are going to die in a week, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and the reason why is because I was given this to my private clients and they're like, man, this is so good. You should make this available to the public. And so I threw it out to the public, and but my whole intention is to serve as many people as possible with it. So that's why I've made it so cheap. But yeah, check it out at the sparkstarterkit.com. And I could just give you the link to it in the show notes if you don't mind putting it in there.
I will. Yeah, I'll include it there.
Yeah. But that's it for me, man. That's how you can reach me.
Sweet. Sweet. Well, once again, thank you for the work that you're doing and the intentionality behind it. Obviously, love all the questions that you're using to help predominantly men, but then by extension, everyone else that's plugging into the work that you're doing. So just thank you for making the change that you are out there, my friend. Thank you. And appreciate you coming on and being a part of the Curated Questions community now. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, man. It's an honor and a privilege. And like I said, I don't take time lightly. So the fact that you and your listeners have given me 60 minutes or whatever it is, it means the world to me. So thank you for having me on the show today.
Cool. Thank you. Ken here. The weekly Substack Curated Questions Dispatch is now live. You can sign up on either Substack or from the Curated Questions homepage. Additionally, the homepage includes a link to record your right now question, which may be included in an upcoming episode. If you have found this show provides you value, please hit that subscribe button and leave a comment. Until I found myself on this side of the microphone, I didn't understand how much of a difference those actions actually do make. And that wraps up another episode. Drop in the comments section of your favorite podcast player the moments that will stick with you. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.